and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And
this hour is brought to you by Team Power, our local John Deere Kubota tractor dealer. They're on 3119 Twinview Boulevard in beautiful downtown Shasta Lake.
Metropolitan Shasta Lake.
That's right. That was Metropolitan Shasta Lake. And, yeah, if you're in the market for a new, used Kubota, John Deere, whatever you're looking for, give us a call down there, and they will definitely help you out. Got a great service team. If you've got problems with service issues, give them a call. They can get you in right away. The phone number down there is 226-9226. And they
have the best website in the tractor world, RedingTractors.com.
That's right.
God, who would have thought of such a thing?
I know, I wonder. Team Power.
All righty. We have two guests today. Today we're going to be switching gears, and I'm just going to spoiler alert right now. The second hour is going to go really fast. We're not going to have enough time, and the good news is he's on for 2 hours next week. So we're going to need every bit of that, because I called him last night to see if he'd come on the show with us, and we were on the phone till like I think it was midnight. So he has a lot of stories. Very interesting man, and it's an amazing topic. Our first hour, we are here with Bruce Moran. And Bruce Moran's a national security advisor, focuses on strategic planning for national security issues. All the good stuff he's doing, he can't tell us about, so I'll just, you know, wreck that for you right there. He is a consultant. He works with public officials, U.S. government committees, departments, agencies, think tanks, corporations. He works on special national security projects and hands-on solutions for crisis preparedness and crisis readiness scenarios. And he's been working a whole lot in North Korea. And that's, I think that's all we get to know. There you go.
Yep.
Well, with that, Bruce, what can you share with us?
A little somber day here, weekend. It's Memorial Day.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up.
My heart goes out to all the families. And this goes back to World War II. We still have some vets from World War II living during their late 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember, one of our presidents was a dive bomber. During World War II, went down. It was Bush Senior,
George W.
Yeah, so he's still going. I remember in his 80s, he was still jumping out of airplanes with a guy helping him, doing parachutes. And
he does.
And it's a different generation, different idea, and about what patriotism was about, and you know how your country is to be served, and God and country, and that. And as we're looking at President Trump, he's actually bringing it back.
You know, I'll tell you what, I listened to his address to the graduates of Annapolis on Friday morning, and it's just nice to have that back, you know, somebody who really cares about our military people.
And recognizes.
Well, it goes back to the Revolution, to the Civil War, we got the Spanish-American War. Excuse me, the War of 1812. I don't want to skip anything. And you know, we have, you know, we're going to talk a little bit today about the Korean War, and what we see today is, you know, ramifications of what happened back in 1952. And to our tremendous vets who served in Korea, thank you. And those who served subsequently in Vietnam, thank you too. That's when they came back from Vietnam. They weren't appreciated, and it took them, I would say, 5 to 6 times longer to readjust to America because everybody looked down on them.
Yeah, they were treated horribly when they came home. And
it's people I knew, you know, too.
Yeah.
It was just...
I'm glad as a country we finally decided that that was wrong and didn't continue that really, really bad behavior.
Yeah.
That's why I say it's a somber day for me, because I still work with vets, talk to vets, you know, the American Legion, the VFW Post. I mean, people don't know about that too much anymore unless they're, you know, involved with it, and they're far removed from understanding what people did for the country and how they sacrifice their lives. You know, it's our precious blood. And I'm just really beside myself because everybody's too busy to really want to get to know how this country is formed. Our American history has been basically thrown out the door. And that's a shame.
And we've turned things like Memorial Day into, you know, like hot dogs and barbecues. And
barbecue. Let's get out 3-day weekend, you know.
Yeah, go out and get in your boat. Yeah, we forget what it's really all about.
Yeah, my cousin still, we have a place, Abraham Lincoln Memorial. It's like the, I would say, Arlington Cemetery. And he's there quite a bit, you know. And it wears on him, and I talk to him about it. And, you know, I'm a sounding board, he's mine. And, you know, he puts the bodies into the ground all the time, you know.
Yeah.
And that whole thing about how you respect and what you do and how the families are. The families carry this their whole lives.
Of course.
People don't realize that. I mean,
it's permanent loss.
23 vets a day that are still committing suicide because of post-traumatic stress from Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, that's a huge toll taken on families to see your loved one take their own life. And it just breaks my heart.
I would, I guess I would be happy to see people actually realize that you put your hand over your heart when the flag is brought into the room. I go to so many things where people don't even know that you put your hand over your heart when the national anthem is played.
Or take off your hat.
Or take off your hat.
Take off your hat.
Take off your hat. Yeah, some of these things, I mean, it's just, it's a respect and honor thing. And, you know, we got all tangled up in the kneeling in the football games. And I thought, well, good, maybe somebody's going to learn what you actually are supposed to do. But we didn't really get that far. We just got tangled in the kneeling.
That's right.
Lovely.
The owners just in the last 2 weeks have come out and said you can't kneel.
Right. Got to hide in the locker room if you're a traitor.
When they're playing the national anthem.
All traitors shall hide in the locker room.
That's true. I mean, of course you get a choice. I think we had this conversation before. And I was saying if the players get to protest, then why not the referees? Why not the cheerleaders? And, you know, everybody has an issue.
Sure.
How about the guys in the stands and the gals in the stands and the
Well, at the end of the day, it's their job.
I mean, you might have an hour before the game for everybody to protest and then let the game go on thereafter.
Yeah, right. Ollie and free. Protest time's over.
I was listening to one of the talk shows last week, and they were, I forget who I was listening to, but they said, you know, when you go to work and you know, you have a regular job and your boss says, hey, these are the rules that we operate under, and if you break those rules, there'll be consequences.
And you
abide by those rules in the workplace. Why is it any different with the NFL? I mean, their bosses say this is what you can and can't do, and if you do it, there's consequences.
It took them a while, but I think they finally realized that they were their employers.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think their actual attendance, they said, went down like 80% or something.
Belt them in the wallet.
Yeah, it was big, and so they decided maybe we better start doing the right thing.
Well, I would encourage people to look around in your local community if you're listening to this on the 27th of May, 2018, because we do replay shows, so if you're listening to this and it's not Memorial Day, we're not time traveling. It really happened on Memorial Weekend. There will be lots of events in your communities on Monday. And then there are always events commemorating actual Memorial Day, which is the 30th. And I know here in Reading, they have a big thing at the Civic out on the lawn every year at 11 o'clock, 11 a.m. on Wednesday, the 30th. So take a look at your local community. If you have kids, it'd be a great way to teach them what Memorial Day is really all about. And then you can get back to, you know, the barbecue. Because then it makes sense. You know, you've done it all as a big picture. All right, we've got to take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Bruce Moran. You're listening to We the People, and you can join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Gone as far as tearing Wallace stickers off the bumpers of cars, and he voted for George McGovern for president. Well, he's a friend of them long-haired hippie-type pick-o fags. I bet you he's even got a commie flag tacked up on the wall inside of his garage. He's a snake in the grass, I tell you guys. He may look dumb, but that's just a disguise. He's a mastermind in the ways of espionage.
What the heck goes through your mind when you pick this music? Holy mackerel.
I don't know. It was kind of hearkening back to a little Vietnam era fun, you know? Easy Rider.
Yeah, I talked to a Marine from Vietnam just this weekend. He said, yeah, we should have won that war. We didn't want to. You know, there were protests going on, and, you know,
there's no
everybody
doubt.
He has a different opinion about Vietnam. You know, it would be a discussion we can have for 2 hours.
Oh, sure.
But I want to get to what the topic of today is, and that's North Korea.
All right,
speaking of wars, we should have won.
You know, but yeah. For history purposes, we know that Korea is divided up into the North and South. And it's divided on the 38th parallel. How did that happen? Well, towards the end of the war in North Korea, when we went in there, General MacArthur was our leader and well-respected, you know, at that time. And we decided after Japan that we weren't going to use a nuclear weapon anymore. And at that time, it was called the atomic bomb. So, you know, I guess they went back and forth to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and then the President and, you know, how you make that decision. But it was decided not to use it. And this was up north when they were at the Chosin Reservoir. So it's called the Battle of Chosin or the Battle of Chosin Reservoir. And I don't think people realize that we're considered U.N. troops, but we constituted, the U.S. Army and Marines constituted about, I'd say 95% of the troops in North Korea at that time. And if you look at who we were fighting, you were thinking, oh, we're fighting the North Koreans. No, we were fighting the Chinese
yeah.
under Mao Zedong. So that's a whole different idea, you know, about what was going on up there. You know, and Mao had a Chinese general he assigned a battle to. His name is Sun Xiulun. And basically they used a tactic from Sun Tzu's book, The Art of War. And they attacked us during a very hard time to move. When would that be? What would you think?
Winter time.
You better believe it. And they used a tactic called surround the enemy. But they also know the countryside, right? So if you do a lot of heavy research, I break it out into four or five simple things, but I can go into 20 or 30 things they were doing. But if we look at what they did is called surround the enemy, and you surround them, but how are they surrounding them? How are they surrounding our posts and our bases in the Chosin Reservoir area? They would attack by night in swarms, in companies. And they also would move at night. And they move vast amounts of people at night. If you know the terrain, what do you have?
Well, they had mountains, and I think they had the high ground in most cases, didn't they?
Well, they knew where to go. They knew mm-hmm. how to move at night.
Right.
So they went around in between you, and that's how they got to test you out. You know what yin and yang are? It's like pressure points.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, they go yin and yang on you. They test your strength, check your weakness, check your strength. This is all going on at the same time. This was a huge 17-day battle at night. So they swarm at night. And then they move at night. They swarm at night, they move at night. They swarm at night, they move at night. And we're talking about swarms of people. You know, they have companies. And they would come in and just, they can swarm in, but they wouldn't have to attack you. They come around you. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then they go in between, and then they surround maybe a post. And you'd be trapped.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, and our guys were pretty much cut off on that battle. I mean, they had no reinforcements and basically had to fight their way out of there.
That's right.
They just got in too deep and got in without any support.
We had intel coming in that there was something coming, but we didn't know how, when, and the Chinese knew how to use it. See what I mean? the Art of War talks about, the first thing you read about the Art of War is what? The number one thing.
Know your enemy.
So you can't tell your enemy what you're doing.
Right.
You do it, and you do it at so many different levels. Now, when I'm talking about the reservoir, you go around the reservoir and do all these things in maybe 20 or 30 spots. You take out the post, and you might take out a base or hit a base and go to another base, take out another post. You see what I mean? It's done so you keep the enemy guessing at all times. And when you outnumber people, you know, like at this, 20, 30 to 1, you know, how many troops they were using at that time on the Chinese side, how many companies. A company constitutes about, well, anywhere between 100, 150 people. Studies have been done, you know. I mean, these are studies that show all around the world that all troops work more efficiently together in groups of 100 to 150. I find that fascinating. When you put anybody together in that kind of a group, they will operate at higher optimum levels. And what would you think one of the first of these things of troop embodiment first came about? Do you recall this at all?
Uh-uh. No, I don't know anything about that.
The Romans.
Of course.
Remember the Romans, big 10x10 groups? They had those big shields and spears.
Yeah.
And then they had the short. They also had that short, once they get in close encounters, they had a short sword, then they strike with that. But they had these long shields, and they call them turtles, and they move in. And then they form arcs over their head and in front to protect them from the arrows coming in. And there would be groups of 100 men, 10x10. Yeah. I find that fascinating. And that strategy carries forward up until today. You know? Mm-hmm. And we're doing asymmetrical guerrilla warfare. You'll see SEAL teams coming in, but they have something like that, but it's in smaller groups. But you can have a whole command go out, but usually it's groups of, I would say, 9 to 15, or depending on what you need in the field. But
well, that's kind of where the
SOG groups are, you know, similarly trained in the guerrilla warfare tactics.
Isn't that where the British box came in as well? They formed that square of layers of men.
That's right, exactly. And that was fought with Wellington and, you know, Napoleon. Wellington took the high ground. He had superior troops, but he had to retreat, you know. So Wellington knew how to, you know, out-strategize Napoleon in that last battle there before he went to Elba. So these are, you know, and so if you look at this tactics around the enemy, I'll give you another example. There's an African group of warriors. Who were the most feared groups of warriors in Africa? Do you remember this?
The Zulus.
Mm-hmm.
The Zulus, yeah. And what the Zulus would do, and some of this is in Sun Tzu's Art of War, if you, you know, want to, you know, correlate it, and the Zulus would send out the first wave of people, and they would test your firepower. I'm talking about when they fought the British. So they lose so many warriors. You just send them out there to attack them. So they're figuring out where they're firing from and how fast they reload. The second group will come out and figure out where the weaknesses were in that firing and reloading. The third group would attack you. Yeah.
God.
They didn't worry about losing warriors. They're just figuring out how to attack you.
Yeah,
so
that was
the mentality of collateral damage, you know, people losing lives has changed completely over the years, you know, and the rules of engagement have changed. So, you know, I talked to Aaron momentarily yesterday, and we're talking about, you know, the World War II, the amount of lives that were lost in battles, you know, bodies upon bodies on the ground, you know, going into D-Day, you know, Normandy, and, you know, different, you know, the Battle of the Bulge, when one of our family members was there, and, you know, that was terrible. You know, he survived. You know, he's one of the 101st Airborne members that survived, so. And it was just brutal. I mean, brutal and cruel and mean. And to survive, you know, we had to do the best we can over there. I don't know if you remember at the Battle of the Bulge, we were trapped and we didn't. Our 101st got decimated and they were in the forest and fighting. So it was really something.
Well, that was also during the winter time as well.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir. So if we get back to the 38th parallel, the reservoir areas where they had that last big battle, and the Chinese just swarmed down, you can say that, and then we retreated, and that's when they came to a peaceful resolution, or they were still at war, because that's what they're doing today. That's where you see President Kim and President Moon from South Korea talking about having a one, you know, Korea model. So,
but didn't
they're looking at peace between the two Koreas?
But didn't MacArthur? He wanted to finish that. He wanted to go all the way to China with that. And I think, you know, when you talk about wars we should have won, I think Korea was a classic example of a war we should have won handily. But it became this political battle rather than a military battle.
We even used all our tools in our
right.
Shed. I mean, if we dropped an atomic bomb, you know, and like we did at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there would have been a lot of loss, you know, but that would have stopped it.
Mm-hmm.
I think at the time, so that was, what, seven years after World War II, we probably had in our arsenal thousands, you know, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 of those kind of bombs.
Mm-hmm.
So we chose not to.
Well, just coming off of World War II, I think people
were devastated.
Yeah, they were. They didn't have the stomach to have these massive casualty counts.
I've been there. You know, I went to Hiroshima and I looked at. You know, they still have all the flowers there. The Japanese are beside themselves. But
mm-hmm.
As we get back to North Korea. Then we're looking at what actually happened, and if you look at 52 and now it's 2018, the Korean people are probably looking to get back together. But how are they going to do it? Oh, as you look at Secretary Pompeo, he's offering them economic incentives to boost their economy. He called it boom the economy. Well, if you're in a economy like the North Koreans, and they're pretty much in the, you know, I would say underbelly of understanding the world markets, and their practices and standards aren't up to world, you know, standards and practices, then you have to come on board and see what you can do. What they will do in, is show them how to get their economy going. Anything you do there will be a boom to them.
Well, yeah, you could send somebody who doesn't know what they're doing, I mean, and could probably make their economy better. Those poor guys.
Yeah, the best example is South Korea is huge, you know, mm-hmm. industrial complex, and they're doing extremely well. So
yeah, you would think just jealousy, they'd want to hang out with them a little bit more.
Well, we got to take a break, but when we come back, let's talk about how you take a regime like they have in North Korea.
That's
into
right.
the 21st century, because, I mean, to give them aid that will actually go towards building their economy versus giving them aid that's just going to fatten the wallet of the regime, I'm not sure how you do that. Let's talk about that when we come
right.
back.
All righty. We'll be right back with our guest, Bruce Moran.
And who leads a life of danger. To everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. He takes odds are he won't live. You see tomorrow. Secret agent man, secret.
Going off to the spirit in the sky. It's where I'm gonna go when I die. When I die and the name is at rest, I'm gonna go to the place that's the best.
Hey, we're back.
Could listen to that song all day.
Yeah. I got one for you. What's President Kim's, one of his favorite songs?
Oh. I don't know.
Rocky.
Really?
Yeah.
Looks the Rocky theme song? Because I immediately thought of Rocket Man, but then that's President Trump's favorite song for
Kim Jong-un.
And we're playing that down right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it's important that we understand that he's a man too, you know, and he has a family and kids and stuff like that. You know, he's a leader of a country.
And a crazy person, but
well,
that notwithstanding,
he's young. He's around 36 years old. So
okay,
to be a leader of a country like that, and that's huge.
So
his temperament is geared towards deferring to his generals and, I would say, to President Xi from China.
Mm-hmm.
He's, you know, learning how to, you know, really get into negotiations with the United States and, you know, have his ally, President Xi from China, you know, help him, you know, get to where they want to go.
Well, see, that's
he did offer. Now, let me explain this. He did offer, you know, a peace solution. He let three prisoners go. Never done before. The North Koreans let three prisoners go. And President Trump, Vice President Pence, and Melania were all at Andrews Air Force Base when they came back. So that was a really nice gesture, you know, to start out. Then last Saturday, he had bombed his nuclear sites in the manufacturing of where you have your nuclear.
But wasn't that
the problem with that is I think he did, but there was no way to, you know, have a strict verification. But no matter what happened, it was a good gesture on his part. I don't think the media was covering these and keeping them in a logical. He is offering through his way, the best way he knows how, to extend the olive branch to have a summit talk with President Trump.
No, I agree. I think he realizes his best move is going to be come to some sort of negotiation with the United States to pull his country out of the dark ages. But I guess my biggest question is, how do you trust somebody that who, you know, their country just has this history of making promises that they never fulfill, and their regime is so, you know, humanitarian wise that they just kill millions of their own people. How does that change?
Yeah, how do we do something that helps those people?
Exactly. How do, you know, if we're going to give them economic relief, how do we do that and guarantee that it's actually going to go towards making their country, you know, a freer place and not just one big death camp?
That's the way the... So you have to have a department in the U.S. government assigned to do that. And what department would that be?
I was going to say we're not short on government departments, so...
No, that would be the State Department.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe we had one specifically just for that. You know, the Lucy and the football department, you know, they work on those special cases.
You need a prime mover, then you have the other agencies work with the prime mover.
Mm-hmm.
So you need Commerce, right?
Right.
Okay, that's, you know, Ross. Secretary Ross, and you need Treasury, you know, and you need, you know, different people to kind of help move that along. But you need a prime mover. That would be Secretary Mike Pompeo. Mike has the wherewithal, you know, to do a lot of these things. Do you recall that he was at West Point at all? Or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's been
doing it. Oh, he's a great guy. I think he would do a fantastic job. It's just whether or not North Korea is going to give us the access to go in and do it.
And assign different parts of the State Department. We had this discussion before. You know how many people work in the State Department?
No.
Zillion.
Did you remember? Okay. It's close to 70,000 people.
Actually, it's not. I mean, 360,000 MBA, 30,000 in the Forest Service.
There's not MBA.
70,000?
That's the problem. That's what Bill's talking about. Do they know how to go in, diplomats?
Mm-hmm.
Start a program up and making sure, and this is what Bill is saying, oversight.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called regional stewardship. And you'd work closely, you know, with Korea, of course, but all the countries in the region. What do you have? Russia there, China, Malaysia, the Philippines, you know, Vietnam. You start trading with them and you watch the markets expand. But what you're talking about, what do you do to make sure that's not being put just into the military budget the monies that are coming through the economic programs.
Which has happened
in
the past.
That's called top-down.
Right.
Okay. So instead of being top-down, you have to go in there for being what? Bottom-up. So they have to integrate it. And that's called NGOs, universities, and the very small businesses and intermediate businesses. You create industrial parks, and you go in there and watch the parks grow. And you monitor it, and you help them educate the people in those areas. So you'll have a diverse group of people that will be starting different kinds of small businesses, intermediate businesses, and creating the industrial park. That's what gives you your diversity. That's what you're talking about. It won't be just one group of people doing one thing. You know, it's not a unilateral military hierarchical thing. If you get a bunch of entrepreneurs coming together and forming all these businesses and starting an industrial park.
I have a hard time. Oh yeah,
how this works. So
I totally understand. I understand what you're saying, but what I'm having trouble believing is that when you have somebody like Un at the top, who has a history of such bizarre humanitarian tactics, how does he change that to give his people more freedom and without his fear of losing control of his country? Because, I mean, he's the iron fist.
That's how it works, though. He gives that latitude to that industrial park.
He has to.
In terms of watching it grow, seeing how it benefits people and how it'll make him much more of a powerful leader as his economy booms and then he has tax revenue coming in.
Right.
I mean, there's a benefit of having businesses grow, you know, and having your economy grow from a, I would call it an underground economy and a extra legal economy to a formal economy, or going from an informal economy to a formal economy. And that's a huge change for the people, because that gives them the wherewithal to keep the industrial park itself lively and economically sound. So each time you create an industrial park, you're creating another vibrant part of the economy where other people in North Korea say, "I want that.
Right, right.
I want to do that."
And I hope he looks at South Korea as a model and not China, because I think China is his mentor, and
That's one of the questions that can be asked. I think that's a great question. How does South Korea and China share their technology?
Right.
How will they get along? And will North Korea grow at a vast amount where it surpasses, you know, the South Koreans?
Right.
I mean, that's a consideration, right? Who's our ally?
Yeah.
South Korea.
Absolutely.
That's one of the considerations that we think of. You know, how do you look at the national security of South Korea as you start introducing the economic boom to North Korea?
Right, and I think that's going to be a fear on China's part to lose control of their little puppet over there and, you know, basically give way to South Korea and the Western, democratic process. Do you think China will be...
I think China will just be hands off and let it go.
Oh, well, that'd be great. Yeah, I.
No, no, China doesn't want to have a war there, because where do all the refugees go?
Right.
Right into China. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the Koreans will be rushing headlong into China. They got to take care of all those people.
That's right.
That is a neighborly consideration.
Yeah, but one of the things too, you got to look at North Korea has all the natural resources that China would like to have. You
know? Oh, I didn't know that.
I did not know that.
Yeah, so that's also in the, I would consider that the eastern part of China, too.
What natural resources does the north have?
You know, the mining, stuff like that.
Oh, minerals. Okay.
Nothing you can eat.
But that's also, it's looking at the east, now they have the same thing in the west.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened in the west. They assumed that territory in the west. What's that called?
Come on, History Channel guy. Call in a lifeline.
I thought that was China.
Well, yeah, it's Tibet, but it's also China.
Oh, okay.
Tibet.
Yeah. So they went in there, and that's such a huge, vast area with such a great amount of natural resources mm-hmm. that they just took it over. So where did Dalai Lama go?
Tibet?
No, I think he's hanging out.
No. He went to North India.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
He escaped.
He's kind of all over the place,
actually. When the Chinese army came in?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay, well, I got one for you. Uh-oh. Where were his bodyguards trained?
Who's the
bodyguards?
The Dalai Lama.
The Dalai Lama?
Yeah.
Taiwan.
Okay, that's a shot.
That took a shot.
Well, that's where they made their clothes. Come on,
okay,
come
I'll
on.
Give you a hint, okay?
Okay.
Aspen area?
Oh. Colorado?
Yep. Colorado, yeah.
Unless there's another Aspen out there somewhere.
Who trained them there?
Friends of yours?
Probably the Special Forces or...
Steven Seagal?
Seagal is there.
Steven Seagal.
Who is Steven Seagal for 100?
He's in Russia right now, so I don't think we should mention his name, you know, but... one of the things that... it was the...
I did that for the sheriff.
During World War... two, this is historical fact, we had the OSS. And after World War II, we had what?
MI6?
No, that's the British.
That's the British.
CIA?
And they've got MI1, MI2.
Yeah, so that's who trained the...
the CIA.
Dalai Lama's, I would call them bodyguards in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's confusing.
Yeah,
they took them into the terrain and, you know...
Obviously, that was secret because we don't know anything about it. Either that or we might be knuckleheads.
Well, they sure as heck didn't tell me about it. I'll tell you that or I would have remembered.
So that, okay, what was not during World War II?
I love this game. This is super fun.
Did you know that we didn't have an Air Force?
That's correct.
During World War II? It was Army Corps. The Air Force came after World War II, the U.S. Air Force. I don't know if you knew that.
Oh, no, I did not know that. I thought we had the Air Force during World War II. Well, yeah. World War One, we didn't have an Air Force.
No. I mean, we had an Air Force, but it's part of the Army Corps.
But it was the Army Air Corps.
Oh, I got you.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. The Air Force didn't separate itself till after World War Two. So we have two things happening at that time.
Okay,
we're going to...
clandestine services of the OSS, and that became the CIA, and then you had the Air Force.
I think
that's pretty good history, you know,
that is
for
history.
People to understand that now we have all these different branches in the military, Joint Chiefs of Staff. I mean, that's how they're looking at what happened and why Kim changed his mind. So,
he looked at that and said, probably going to not win, so.
What did he see, though? I mean, just recently, in the last year from President Trump, what did he see? President Trump, and this
willingness
is
to come and whoop him.
If you're firm and resolute in your decision making,
mm-hmm.
you act.
Yep.
You have to act. That's what Sun Tzu says. You have to act. President Trump acts. What he says he does, he does.
Right.
So where did he act? And what was why did Kim understand that? He's going to act against him in North Korea.
All right, we're going to have to call a lifeline during the break. Saved by the break. So great. So good. So good to have a break.
And then you'll have my final answer.
Final answer. We'll come up to the break. You're listening to We the People. We're going to be back in 2 minutes. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Thank you.
See, now you can go with John Cougar Mellencamp for your theme when you're negotiating,
or you can go with James Taylor and You Got a Friend, but that didn't work out so well.
Yeah, we decided that the answer wasn't
James.
Take the girl bike riding John Kerry with James Taylor to negotiate.
Yeah, that.
Anything other than that spells world business.
Also Iran and give him, $500 billion and say,
yeah.
Yeah. We're going to give you a whole.
Nuclear weapons and.
Yeah, if you promise.
A year and a half later, we're going,
Well, you promised to do it. We'll give you all your money back. Yeah, no, that's not how we play.
Yeah, Mike Pompeo was there talking about that on the air, too. And he was talking about Iran. This is also this weekend. It's a very serious situation because we let our back door down, and Iran just squirms right through it. So,
yep.
Thank you.
yep. And I think
that door is
closing hard right now on
I'm
Iran.
I'm not using the back door as another example for our cybersecurity. In the end of 2016, all our CIA tools were given up. That was the back doors to computers,
mm-hmm.
how they use their offensive techniques. Nobody did anything about that. So we had these vulnerabilities that existed, and now President Trump is being resolute and firm, like I'm getting back to our conversation in Sun Tzu Art of War, and he's taking it to the table.
Right.
I'm talking about the negotiation table, and hopefully the summit is on June 12th.
Right.
And your concern was, how is he understanding that he has to come to the table? And my point was, President Trump is firm and resolute because he drew the line in Syria. He saw that, and he struck twice.
Mm-hmm.
Second time, there were, I believe, 110 bombs coming in, and they were perfectly executed at 4 a.m. in the morning.
Plus, he got
thinking to himself.
Plus, he got our allies to go in with him. I mean, it wasn't just
from four different spots.
Exactly.
And he's thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do to defend against that if I screw up at some point?
Right.
But there was something else that was very important, too, that was demonstrated.
Well, I think that was his willingness to pull out.
There was another incident that happened where we used something.
Hey, Steven Seagal?
No,
okay.
No, it was in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan.
We used the mother of all bombs there.
Oh, that's right.
That's right.
That's a bomb.
I forgot about that.
You know where he has all his nuclear stuff? In the mountains in North Korea there? You drop one of those there and...
Goodbye.
Hasta la vista, the Terminator comes out and you take care of that. I mean, you drop three or four of them, but, and for the amount of area they cover, but it'll make a different impression on the people that aren't left there.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
You don't have nothing to say, and that's a pretty big statement, that you wipe out everything and they're gone.
Yeah, and there's no, we don't have any ground troops to worry about. I mean, that would really...
You just take care of all those...
Yeah.
Places that he has his nuclear sites and missiles. It's just not nuclear, but it's missiles that are pointing at North Korea. If North Korea decides to attack, we know we're going to lose Seoul.
Oh, yeah, South Korea is gone.
There's a second city, in central Korea that everybody flees to. But can you imagine that we lose half the people in Seoul? Or maybe 70%, depending on the kind of attack.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they said maybe a million people would die if he unleashed the...
Easy.
Yeah, it's just his artillery that he has on the DMZ into South Korea. It would.
Yeah.
But we can't stop that.
No. But he knows once that's a commitment, he's done. That's what I'm saying.
In the end.
We got a few Mohabs there. We got our THAAD missiles. We got our submarines. We got our battleships. That's what he was a little worried about recently. He was saber-rattling because we were doing our maneuvers there. And you send over our bombers, and it's like I said, hasta la vista,
sure.
And everything goes.
Yeah, sure. Short
whatever
game.
He had there would be vanquished.
Yeah, he'd have a first strike capability that would be pretty devastating.
It would be
but
called
the long
a last
game,
strike.
Yeah, the long game is he's no longer around, and I think he realizes that.
I think that's what I was drawing the same conclusion by giving these examples.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe he can survive. I'm not saying he can't survive, but he might end up in China.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing. As that country, if let's say they do make a deal and they do start to develop and become more.
Well, they'll have elections. Remember?
Right. Right. And they're not going to want
together
him.
And they have elections.
Yeah.
And that'll change the whole dynamics.
So I think that's what he's afraid of.
Well, it'll take a while to deprogram everybody.
No, we don't know. What was that best example? What we saw that most recently, where two separating countries, communist and west, came together.
Recently?
Okay, last 25 years.
Okay, I was like...
I'm thinking historically.
I'm like, recently?
Last week.
Last week, I'm thinking...
Southern California, where those sanctuary cities were tossed out. No,
yeah. I was going to say, what is the Mexican border by San Diego?
No, I'm talking about historically, where we saw a communist side and
sure.
a western side come together.
Ukraine, maybe?
Ukraine, I don't think that was, it's a little more sophisticated in Ukraine. Now you have to talk about that for a whole hour. Mm-hmm. Crimea and Khrushchev in 52 and mm-hmm. how that all evolved into Sevastopol, the military base, and they had agreements all the way to 2042 with Russia, and they had their own parliament in Crimea. I don't know if people know this stuff. They had their own president there, but they decided not to have a president. I think it was in about 7 or 8 years ago, but they still had their own parliament in Crimea. So mm-hmm. there's a whole geopolitical, strategical idea about Ukraine. I mean, it's fertile agricultural base there. It's just unbelievable. It would be like California was probably 40 years ago.
Still a little bit radioactive up in the north end there, but other than that, it's pretty nice country.
But I'm talking about Ukraine in where they have all their farming.
All
region.
The farms, sure.
Yeah.
And that's because the topsoil, that's what I'm talking about. The California topsoil isn't the same today as it was 50 years ago.
No.
They have all that there. So that's like a really rich area to provide agricultural base for a lot of different reasons. So that's a geopolitical decision that's made. So, I mean, that's a whole different thing. But we're talking about now Germany. Germany is probably the best example where East came together
sure.
with West.
Berlin Wall.
There was under President Reagan when he met with Gorbachev and they tore down the wall in 91.
Well, I think that's going to be what I think the folks in the world are going to be looking for is another Berlin Wall incident in North Korea. And I think it's possible. God, I wish we had another hour. We could talk about that whole thing.
How much time do we have?
A minute.
About a minute left.
About a minute? Okay, I want to thank all the veterans' families. God bless you. Thank you, Chief of Staff Kelly. You lost one of your sons. Thank you, General Mattis.
We love General Mattis. And you know what? If I was Kim Jong-un, I'd be thinking about General Mattis.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's great.
You wouldn't want the mad dog coming after you. That's a deterrent.
I'm breaking up here, personally, you know.
I know. I heard you. I was trying to have some happy chatter in the background.
Yeah. I'm just...
I know.
It gets my heart going because it's terrible.
It is, and it's a... it's a good thing we keep Memorial Day. I don't think they're trying to get rid of it for some unknown reason. I think we get to keep it as Memorial Day. So
that's right.
Thank you.
They didn't merge it with another.
they didn't turn it into some kind of solstice or some weirdo thing. So thank you to all of our military veterans.
Absolutely, thank you.
And their families and those who have sacrificed
all
of it. Thank
all the veterans, their families. It goes all the way back to World War II. You're brave. You're wonderful Americans, and God bless you all.
Thank you, Bruce.
Thanks a lot, Bruce.
And we'll be talking again real soon.
We will chat with you very soon.
Okay, thank you.
We're going to come back with Dr. Harry Booyans. We're going to shift gears and talk about South Africa. You're not going to want to miss it. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.